It's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Anne Strainchamps. Today, imagining the future. Not some doomsday scenario of global meltdown, but everyday life, 50 or, say, 100 years from now.
It's quite possible that more than 50%, more than 90% of people will not be able to come up with anything that they can do that will create enough value to make for a living wage.
Between the economic growth and the population growth, we may be on a track of needing to about double the food availability in the world.
Today, architects, technologists, and writers talk about the challenges we face and the future we'll build to solve them. Let's start at home. Imagine it's the year 2055, a regular weekday morning. Where do you wake up? Mitchell Joachim is an urban designer and architect, and he's the co-founder of the design group Terraform One. And his idea is that in the future, instead of building homes, we could grow them.
I think that, you know, we've had, a number of centuries where we've been thinking about building, where everything has been more mass-produced, highly unitized, incredibly modular. And in the more recent industrial age, everything is about this kind of factory model. Our group, Terraform One, has been looking at alternates, a link to the resources that the Earth's provided us, but do it in a way that we don't deplete them. And one such kind of system is thinking about living architectures, architectures that are comprised of directly of the metabolism or the systems you'd find in nature, and nudging them for human use, nudging them into geometries that are spaces that are occupiable, homes that are simply made from living elements that are adjusted so that we could find some sort of space or sanctity inside them.
I'm not totally sure I understand what you mean. Can you describe one?
I'll get into that minutia. So one project, Fab Treehab, is taking living trees or any woody plant matter, vines, etc., and growing them into a shape. So we provide scaffolding that's designed using computers and allowing the vines to be shaped inside that scaffolding and growing them into a home, attaching them to larger woody plant species such as trees and grafting all of the components together. So they form one contiguous plant system.
What would it look like?
It would look like a home that would be essentially a part of the landscape. Almost no distinction between home and landscape. It would welcome all kinds of critters and creatures on the outside. And you can imagine it would be a treehouse, unlike nothing you've maybe seen before. But at the same time, it's just as if the landscape was folded up for a moment and you could get inside underneath it and live there. The inside would be like any other home. You could put your TV and your couch and plaster the walls. But the structure and the exterior would be made up of loam or mud filled in inside these woody plants and vines.
It sounds like something for elves or hobbits to live in.
Yeah, well, you know, there's nothing wrong with that. But hobbit homes look like they fit into nature. And it's a different directive than we have today, which is this kind of box that makes up so much of the suburbs. It's just not sustainable to continuously construct these kinds of homes.
So are you imagining, I don't know, future cities or villages that look more like urban forests in which there are all these kind of tree homes and little creatures are running around and there's leaves and little streams running through? Or is this too pastoral?
Something wrong with the American sublime and these pastoral ideas of the countryside. I think it's – if there will be folks living in the suburbs, I think the topology of the suburb, the basic building stock that we understand today is got to shift into something that has a kind of a fitness with nature. And we could use trees as they are and woody plants as they are in their local ecosystems and shape them for our own functional purposes. I think – on the site in the very location you desire to live, you could have a village for thousands of families made from the materials that are available there. The biggest criticism I've gotten for doing something like that is people are worried it takes a lot of time. But I think if we wait 12 years for a bottle of scotch, we can wait 12 years to grow a village of homes for 1,000-plus families that have a positive contribution to the environment.
I'm curious, as an architect, somebody who thinks deeply about what houses are and what they mean to us and our relationship with our houses, the structures we live inside, do you think we would have a different feeling about a house that was literally alive?
I mean, that's a great perspective. I think absolutely we would have a different connection, if not kinship, to a home that is living. There would be some idea of sentience. This is a breathing, connected mechanism to the earth, and we would have to respect it as such, as opposed to dead, harvested materials that have been processed, highly processed through some industrial system. I might even go so far that even in a distant future, we would think of extended phenotypes for people, much like a bird has a nest, which is very important to the life of the bird, or a spider and a web, a beaver and a dam, etc. These are kind of logical and built-in evolutionary extensions of the of those organisms. Humans at some point have probably lost that instinctual link to nature to make homes. So there's probably be a deeper return to that in the future at some point.
Were you raised on a lot of Grimm's fairy tales? Because all of this, it just sounds like something out of, those fairy tales.
Oh, thanks. Truth be told, many architects have been thinking about this for some time. They were called bioformalists. I mean, it started with someone like Frank Lloyd Wright, who talked about organic architecture. If you think of another famous architect in America, Frank Gehry, his forms for the Walt Disney Concert Hall are very organic, if I can use the term here, loosely flowing, very curvilinear, but essentially they're not organic. They are steel, metal, and glass. So the next logical phase has been this new generation, which I guess I'm a part of, is architects actually taking the computational systems extracted from nature, principles from Frank Lloyd Wright, and actually making a truly organic architecture where we're really working at the genetic level, or we're working with natural materials and growing them to perform as living systems.
So how would you scale that up to create mega cities?
Well, it's one step at a time. It's going to take a lot of folks working for a decade or more to solve some of the bigger problems that we're looking at in creating truly living architectures. I think that if cities are meant to be built today, to get them to be absolutely living, be a very difficult and expensive process. And unfortunately, we'll have to use more conventional means to build some of these cities. But that doesn't mean the infrastructure, the stuff that deals with waste, food, water, air quality, et cetera, mobility, isn't made to have a kind of a connection to nature, and that these kinds of flows, these metabolic flows, will link the cities logically so that we can have a sustainable urbanism.
So let's play out a couple of future scenarios. I mean, say we figure out how to build cities with new, more biological materials. Can you kind of paint a picture, walk me through the built environment of a person who might be living in a middle American city with an average income?
Well, first, let's hope we get there. If we can get past the amount of carbon we're putting in the atmosphere, think of a set of controls on our growth and our economy and all sectors, and that we're able to kind of be around the next 100 years because we figured out the system. I would imagine that someone in the future would be living in a place where there is no waste. Even the concept of waste would be completely gone away. There would be no term for waste. Everything would be upcycled constantly in a nutrient stream where it's being used and reused. And I would think that transportation would also be very different. So if you wake up in the morning, you would get to work if you don't work at home through a transportation system that is designed to fit cities. So it's not a kind of a universal one like the automobile is. We'll have a lot of shared ownership models for moving, public transportation, et cetera, and models of transportation that fit directly into the architecture.
So as we look at a future with a massive population increase and these megacities, how are officials and urban planners and architects preparing for the growth of American cities right now?
We're arguing. Yeah, I think that's healthy. It's a large-scale, long-term polemic, fighting over utopia, which most of us dismiss outright, not because utopia is a bad idea, but because many of us think there's a lot of good examples where it's failed. I would think that it's not about establishing a fantastic Shangri-La or some perfect environment for everybody. I think it's actually more of goal of achieving a maximal answer to current real-world problems. And that, to me, is what a utopia is.
Mitchell Joachim is a prize-winning architect and ecological designer, and he's the co-founder of Terraform One. Now, if you want to see some of his organic house designs, visit our website at ttbook.org. So we're imagining that it's the year 2055. Your future self has woken up in a living home. It's a weekday morning and time for work. But what kind of work? With the economic crisis we're currently living through, the rise of the information economy and the death of the old industrial economy, how many of us will even have jobs in the future? To tackle that question, Steve Paulson sat down with the well-known information economist, MIT's Eric Brynjolfsson.
Eric, what's shaping the future of our work lives?
Well, technology has always been changing our work lives, but lately technology has been accelerating, especially digital technologies. And so that's caused some really good things. Productivity's at a record high. Profits are at record highs. We're wealthier than we ever were before. But it's also caused some not so good things. The person at the 50th percentile of income distribution is poorer than he or she was in the 1990s. And of course, unemployment has been soaring as the share of people working has fallen.
Mm-hmm. Now, there have been predictions over the centuries even about what was supposed to happen with new technology. I mean, if you go back to, electricity or the first robots or the invention of computers, there were all these people who had this very sort of rosy look that, we're going to work less, but we'll still have good incomes. And mm-hmm. It does not seem to have worked out that way. And the interesting thing is I don't see that kind of optimism anymore. I mean, now I don't hear people saying, with new technology, it's going to make our lives easier. What has changed?
Well, the technology is doing what it's supposed to be doing, and that is it is actually creating more wealth with less work. The problem is that our institutions, our skills, our organizations aren't keeping up. And so we're having a bigger and bigger mismatch between the technology and the rest of society. The result has been that this saving of work has not been evenly distributed. A small group of the population has really borne the brunt of this unemployment, and they're not working at all, even though they'd like to. And a lot of other people are working as much as ever, in fact, maybe too much. And the big challenge before us is to reinvent our organizations and institutions to keep up with the radical changes in technology.
What would that mean, to reinvent our institutions and organizations?
Well, technology has always been creating jobs. It's always been destroying jobs. 200 years ago, 90% of Americans worked on farms. And then it was 42% in 1900. And now it's less than 2%. But along the way, we changed the kinds of work people did. All those people who aren't working on farms, they didn't simply become unemployed. Thomas Edison and Henry Ford and Steve Jobs and others helped invent entirely new industries. Today, that isn't happening nearly as rapidly. Sure, there's a fair amount of entrepreneurship, but the companies that are being started today don't need as many people. We're going to have to think about ways that people can be employed in new industries, and also we may have to start thinking about ways that people can share in the wealth even if they aren't working as much.
Now, are you getting at a divide between those who work in the tech industries and those who don't? I mean, basically, those who are the high-tech workers are, they're going to be sitting pretty. They'll be employed. They'll, make money. But the others will kind of be left out?
Well, that would be the first instinct is to look at it that way between tech and the rest of the economy. Actually, there's three sets of winners and losers. The first set is between high-skill workers and low versus middle-skill workers. People with only a high school education today have seen their incomes just fall off a cliff. The second one is between capital owners and labor providers. So as companies automate their operations, people who own capital equipment have captured a bigger and bigger share of the pie, and people who provide labor, who work in those factories, don't have as much to offer anymore. And then the third set of winners and losers is between what I would call superstars, or very lucky or talented individuals who have some special skill, and really the rest of us. All three of those sets of winners and losers have been affected increasingly by technology, and the gap is growing between the winning set and the losing set. And they all point in the same direction, which is greater income inequality and less job growth for the mass of people in the United States and other developed countries.
I have to say, this sounds like a fairly grim scenario for the future. I mean, most people are going to be left out, and they're not going to have those high skills. And it sounds like a fairly pessimistic future, doesn't it?
Well, it doesn't have to be. But certainly, if we do nothing, if we just continue the way we're going right now, it is a pessimistic future for 90% of people, or maybe even 99% of people. And I guess that's a pretty grim scenario. But it doesn't have to be that way. We could reskill a lot of people. We could change the way capital is allocated. We could try to be more aggressive about encouraging entrepreneurship. What we need to do is invent those new industries, like, say, Henry Ford and Steve Jobs did, that will employ people that have been, if you will, freed up from the old tasks. We're not doing that fast enough.
So what you're really talking about is the need to radically restructure our institutions, the way we think about work, the way we train people for productive lives. And I guess I'm wondering if this is just sort of going to happen organically, or whether there needs to be a more concerted policy to make it happen. I mean, is this the kind of thing that governments need to jump in on and spend billions of dollars to push us in the right direction?
I wish I could be more optimistic about government being helpful in this process. So far, there seems to be real paralysis down there. I mean, I love visiting Silicon Valley or visiting the labs here at MIT or all over the country. People are doing very dynamic things with technology. But I'm disappointed whenever I go to Washington and see the paralysis and infighting there. Few, if anybody, down there are thinking about these kinds of issues the way they need to. We have to actively redesign it, just as people did in the 20th century, when we moved from a farming agrarian economy to an industrial economy. There was a tremendous amount of restructuring of government and industry and regulation, and even our norms and our customs of how we ran organizations were quite radically redesigned. What I'm calling for going forward is a grand challenge to reinvent education and organizations right alongside the way that technology has been reinvented.
So who needs to take charge of this process?
I think we all need to get involved. I don't think we can wait for government to do it. I don't think there's going to be a single shining entrepreneur who rallies it all. The way these things tend to happen is by thousands or millions of people working on different parts of the problem, somebody picking out working on the education reinvention, other people looking at ways to get crowdsource employment opportunities in the sharing economy, for instance.
So, you know, in this hour, we are asking people to project forward 50 years to imagine what a typical American's day-to-day life might look like. So here's the hard part here. If you were to imagine an optimistic scenario, walk us through what the workday of a typical American might be.
Well, you're right to point out that there are different scenarios. And I think that is probably the most important point, is that there's no single inevitable future. It's going to depend entirely on how we choose to take action in these areas. And I do think there's a very optimistic scenario, and one that I hope is the more likely one. And that is one where there's no more physical wants and needs. Robots can take care of the work needed to provide food, clothing, shelter, and basic physical needs for everyone on the planet. We're not that far away from that point. The interpersonal skills won't be automated, but that's fine. There'll be room for people to do that, and we'll spend more time on interacting with each other and engaging in different kinds of leisure pursuits.
This sounds pretty good. So I'm going to be kicking painting landscapes and hanging out over coffee, talking with friends, and the robots are going to be doing all the work. Not bad.
I think it's a very realistic scenario, but it depends in large part on how we decide to allocate income and the wealth that's created. Because another scenario is one where the same amount of wealth is created, but it's highly concentrated in not even the 1%, but the 1% of the 1%. We have to decide what kinds of trade-offs we want between, say, creating more incentives for innovation and creating a more even distribution of income. That's a debate that we need to have, and I think that we will be having over the coming years.
Okay, I'm going to ask you to be a little more specific about the pessimistic scenario. Suppose we don't do this. Suppose we don't figure out ways to redistribute capital and wealth. What might the average day look like 50 years from now?
Yeah. Well, I see two broad kinds of pessimistic scenarios. The first one is the one that's an economic pessimism, where there's a tremendous amount of inequality. It's quite possible that the mass of people, more than 50%, more than 90% of people, will not be able to come up with anything that they can do that will create enough value to make for a living wage. But they could still be very, very angry and create a lot of destruction. You see glimpses of that with the Tea Party, Occupy Wall Street, and other revolutions that happen when people feel they're not getting a fair share. I think both those groups are correct that they're not getting a fair share. They're incorrect in not understanding why that's happening. It's not so much because of greed on Wall Street or corruption in Washington. It's because of some big, powerful technological forces. And we need to get the diagnosis right before we jump to prescriptions. And if we do get the diagnosis right, then I think that righteous anger can be directed towards redesigning and inventing a system that is more broadly beneficial. But if it's not, I could easily see growing unrest and disorder. It's happened before, and there's no reason that it wouldn't happen again. So it's in the interest of all of us to think about ways of heading that off.
That is great. Thank you so much. This is fascinating.
My pleasure, and I hope we end up in that happy scenario that we discussed.
Me too.
Eric Brynjolfsson, talking with Steve Paulson. Eric directs the MIT Center for Digital Excellence. His most recent book is The Second Machine Age. So what do you think? Are you optimistic or pessimistic about the future? Comment on our Facebook page. I'm Ann Strainchamps. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI. Public Radio International. We're trying to imagine what everyday life might be like 50 or so years from now. So far, your future self woke up in a house made of living materials, went to work, if you're lucky enough to have a job, and now it's time for lunch. Let's hope there's still food. Jonathan Foley directs the University of Minnesota's Institute on the Environment, and a while ago, he told Jim Fleming that if you want to talk about feeding the world, forget about the future.
Today, right now, we have three major challenges facing the world food system. One is the challenge of what we call food security, which is just a fancy way of saying, does everybody get enough to eat every day? And right now, we have 7 billion people in the world, but sadly, about a billion people don't have food security. They lack the income or the access or the infrastructure to get food every single day. That's not because we don't grow it. There's plenty of food being grown. It's just these folks don't have access to this, mainly because they're very poor or they live in places with bad institutions. And that's true many places in the world, including a little bit of the United States. The second big challenge, though, is the world's getting bigger. Population growth, we have 2 to 3 billion more people coming to the population in the next 50 to 60 years, possibly. Also, though, the world is getting richer. China alone will be adding about 500 million middle-class consumers in the next 10 to 20 years. And with that, we're seeing big changes in diet. Folks who are getting richer are looking to Europe and the U.S. and other places and saying, hey, maybe I want to eat more meat, more fats, more sugar, more oils, things like that. So between the economic growth and the population growth, we may be on a track of needing to about double the food availability in the world.
It's hard to break these things apart, isn't it? You can't really talk about how much food we produce without also considering getting it from the place of production to the people who need it.
Well, that's absolutely true. I mean, it's really ironic that the world grows a considerable amount of food, but then you have to ask, where does it go? We see a lot of the crops we grow are actually fed mainly to animals. If you drive across the Midwestern Corn Belt, you look at all that corn and all those soybeans. That isn't people food. It's mainly fed to animals and increasingly to make ethanol. So we have to think not only about how much we grow, but what we're using it for. And that's a pretty big opportunity is around diets and biofuels and especially food waste. The world wastes about 40%, it's estimated, of all the calories grown in the world. We could do better than that.
I imagine there must be another issue, though, and that would be, and maybe it's related to that, and that would be the effect on the environment. One of the things in your research that I confess really surprised me was how much effect on climate change the agricultural industry has. I would have thought agriculture would be a good thing.
Yeah, it turns out the most important thing we do in civilization is farming, and without it, we wouldn't be here. But yet, it's also kind of a paradox because agriculture has now become one of the biggest drivers of environmental degradation around the world as well. about 30% of the greenhouse gas emissions going into the atmosphere don't come from energy. They come from agriculture. It's actually the biggest source of any economic sector. The next biggest would be all the world's transportation, cars, trucks, airplanes, everything else. That's about 15%. So agriculture is double everything that moves on the planet. Mainly emissions from agriculture come from deforestation, cutting down rainforest in Brazil, Indonesia, and other places, and burning them. The second biggest source comes from something called methane, which is a gas that comes out of cows, out of the front end of a cow, not the back end, by the way. A lot of people get that wrong. But also rice fields release methane, too, when they're flooded year-round. And the third biggest contributor to climate change from agriculture is something called nitrous oxide. And that comes from over-fertilized fields when we apply too much nitrogen fertilizer on certain kinds of soils. Ironically, it's not due to things like food miles or organic versus conventional or using chemicals on the farm, all the things we typically associate with conventional agriculture and things that might be good about like local food and organic. That's really not a big issue for climate change.
I guess that we've established pretty well that there are problems. Will we be able to feed the increase in the population?
Well, it's yes and no. It depends on how you try to do it. Right now, we have a very, very pervasive kind of narrative out there that says, look, the world's population is getting bigger, people are getting richer, we've got to double the world's food supply. And I would say, yes, that's probably true. But then, therefore, we need to grow more stuff. And I'm thinking, well, wait a minute. We waste 40% of all the food we grow in the world right now. A lot more people are eating more things like meat and dairy products, which are not always very efficient. We're using more and more of our crops for biofuels, taking it away from the food system. So maybe we could conserve some of the food we have now and use it better rather than just simply growing more.
So how do we do that? Because the waste that you're talking about, the immediate reaction is, you mean the cereal that I threw away when I didn't eat my whole bowl this morning?
Well, there are two ways to look at this. One is exactly throwing things away. It's just basically losses along the supply chain. So it's either between the farmer and the marketplace, which happens a lot in poor countries. The farmer grew the crop, but it never got to market because it spoiled or, you know, couldn't be refrigerated or didn't get there on time. But in rich countries, we tend to throw away things post-consumer. It's in our refrigerators, our trash cans, our cafeterias, our dorms, our restaurants. And a lot of things can be done there, especially where there are large institutions.
So who is going to shape the future of food? Is it the government with increased regulation? Is it simply a matter of educating consumers?
Well, there's a lot of interesting forces playing out in the food system right now. Right now, we certainly have governments and their ability to regulate either how food is grown in agriculture, but mainly we do that through our farm bill, what we pay for and what we subsidize versus what we ignore. But also industry has a big role here. That's pretty influenced by consumer opinion. You know, the big foodie movement in the United States and around the world now is changing people's attitudes around food quite a lot.
Is it changing it in a good way? I guess I'm curious. There's this argument between industry and organic or locally grown food. Is that a positive thing? Is that making a difference to people's diet?
I think it is improving people's nutrition somewhat. I'm not sure it's having that big an effect on, let's say, the global food system yet. For example, organic food is about – that's only about 1% or less of the global food system. And GMOs, which people get all upset about and everything, well, they're about maybe 10% of the world's food production. We tend to get very, very obsessed about kind of small things, like, you know, whether something is grown within 50 miles of your house. It turns out it doesn't matter that much to the global climate or the environment or any of that. What's really important is to do things like, can we stop deforestation in the Amazon and Indonesia, for example? You know, is something certified organic or not? What's more important is that a good farm? Is it a farm that didn't pollute into its local water? Did it produce good, healthy food that people can eat? So how do we move beyond these labeling good and bad kind of thing to a more comprehensive, big picture view of agriculture?
Let's pretend for a moment that these are these are situations that can be solved and that we are going to solve them. What do you think? What am I going to have for breakfast if I'm still alive 50 years from now?
Well, I think what we'll have to eat 50 years from now, I mean, who knows, but we'll probably be not that different than what we have today in many ways. I think, obviously we'll see more homogenization around the world. We'll see more people borrowing diets and cultures and food from each other. And that's a good thing, probably. But I'm actually pretty optimistic. I think we will make it. I think we'll be able to feed the growing world population. But I think we're going to get better about food waste. We might see a lot more deployment of technology, like having robots traveling around farm fields, kind of measuring soil nutrition and water content and growth. Maybe we'll have more sensors and kind of a ubiquitous kind of web presence, making sure as food travels around the world, it isn't getting spoiled or we know exactly where it is. But I would argue that maybe we could be optimistic about this with improvements in farming technology, not just genetics, but things like how we fertilize our soils, how we irrigate. And it might be very low-tech things like using more manures and more drip irrigation and maybe borrowing from organic approaches and what we call agroecology. I think those things have a lot of promise.
These are things that society needs to do. There are economic possibilities. There are political possibilities. What about individual possibilities? What can an ordinary consumer do to make sure that there will be good food and clean water for our kids and our grandkids?
Well, I think the biggest role we have as individuals isn't just in our pocketbooks. I mean, a lot of people want to buy the local and the organic and the farmers markets and all that. That's great. That's wonderful. But I think a more powerful thing you do when you do that is you set examples for other people, especially your kids or your coworkers or your friends. Everybody could have a backyard little garden to grow a salad in. That won't really make a dent in global food supplies, but it'll help teach people around you and yourself even how the food system works, how we have to take care of our soils and our plants. And I like to think of that as a gateway drug to getting people interested in food and being more healthy, more nutritious, but also respecting a lot more what farmers do. We need to reconnect people to the food system, and anything we can do that is probably a good thing to do at the individual level.
Jonathan Foley directs the University of Minnesota's Institute on the Environment. He talked with Jim Fleming. One thing you can say for certain about the future is that the past repeats itself. That's a theme that runs through Children of the Days, the latest book from the celebrated Latin American writer Eduardo Galeano. The book has an entry for every day of the year, which ranges from tales of ancient Egypt to the story of a human cannonball launching over the U.S.-Mexico border.
It's a strange book. It's born from a sentence I heard years and years ago in a Mayan community in Guatemala about the Mayan culture as the only one in the Americas in which time is the mother and the father of space. We are all daughters and sons of days. And so, if we are sons and daughters of time, then we are made of stories, each one of us. You and I, we contain a lot of stories. On the third day of the year 47 before Christ, the most renowned library of antiquities burned to the ground.
After Roman legions invaded Egypt, fire devoured most of the thousands upon thousands of papyrus scrolls in the Library of Alexandria. A pair of millennia later, after American legions invaded Iraq, most of the thousands upon thousands of books in the Library of Baghdad were reduced to ashes. Throughout the history of humanity, only one refuge kept books safe from war and conflagration, the walking library, an idea that occurred to the Grand Vizier of Persia at the end of the 10th century. This prudent and tireless traveler kept his library with him. 117,000 books aboard 400 camels formed a caravan a mile long. The camels were also the catalog. They were arranged according to the titles of the books they carried, a flock for each of the 32 letters of the Persian alphabet.
I'm trying to help to rediscover the human rainbow. It has been mutilated by a long, long time of racism and machismo and militarism. And in the official memory, we have so many women that should be there and are not. and black people and Indians statues that should be instead of statues that should not be but are.
January 24, Civilizing Father. On this day, in 1965, Winston Churchill passed away. In 1937, speaking before the Palestine Royal Commission, he offered one of his frequent lessons on the history of humanity. "I do not admit that a great wrong has been done to the Red Indians of America or the black people of Australia by the fact that a stronger race, a higher grade race, has come in and taken their place." August 9, International Day of Indigenous Peoples. Rigoberta Menchú was born in Guatemala 4 centuries and a half after the conquest by Pedro de Alvarado and 5 years after Dwight Eisenhower conquered it once more. In 1982, when the army swept through the Mayas Highlands, nearly all of Rigoberta's family was wiped out. 10 years later, she received the Nobel Peace Prize. She declared, "I receive this prize as an homage to the Maya people, even though it arrives 500 years late. The Mayas are a patient people. They have survived 5 centuries of butchery. They know that time, like a spider, weaves slowly."
The stories come and touch me, touch my shoulder or my back, and say, "Tell me, I deserve to be told. tell me. I have a long line of candidates of days that want to be told.
Eduardo Galeano's latest book is called Children of the Days, A Calendar of Human History. You can hear an extended conversation with him on our website, ttbook.org. When we come back, we'll celebrate Women's History Month with the forgotten story of Ben Franklin's better half, his sister Jane. I'm Ann Strainchamps. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International.
You are about to experience a totally new dimension in
ideas, the intellectual thrill ride of the year. To the Best of Our Knowledge proudly presents
Dangerous
Ideas.
Hi, I'm Olivia Lang. I'm the author of The Trip to Echo Spring, and my dangerous idea is loneliness as a gift. I'm fascinated by loneliness. I'm fascinated by the way it inhibits us, by the way it closes us off, but also by the potential it might have as a creative source. The book I'm working on now, The Lonely City, has its origins in a period I spent living in New York. It was an intensely lonely time, and it was also the most receptive I think I've ever been to art. I was interested in the ways in which different kinds of alienation, different kinds of suspicion of the group, desire to move away from the group or desire to form kind of separate oppositional communities like Andy Warhol's factory, might have to do with art. Loneliness is intensely damaging to the physical self. It raises blood pressure, it causes poor sleep, it leads to early death, in fact, which is a terrifying thought. People aren't designed to be lonely. I talked to scientists about this, and while I believed what they were saying, it didn't quite square with my own experience, because it seemed to me that there was a kind of sensitivity that happens when people are longing for contact. One of the things that they told me about was hypervigilance, that when you're lonely, you go into a state of hypervigilance, you're very alert. And it was that I was really fascinated by. I really wanted to get to grips with the kind of alertness that happens and the kind of desire to maybe create work that speaks to your sense of isolation. And there was something in that drew me to David Voinarovich in particular. He was an artist, a gay artist, who eventually died of AIDS, an AIDS activist as well. And he wrote about the way that he made work out of a sense of feeling that no one understood, that he spoke a secret language that no one understood, but that as he made work, it made him feel less alone, and that it also acted to draw other people who understood it, who were drawn to it, who belonged to the same secret tribe. And that really interested me, so I wanted to get to grips with the ways in which, although the physical desire to have other people around might feel very painful, it might also be the foundation for some, even much, of the work that we enjoy so much.
Olivia Lang with A Dangerous Idea. You'll find more Dangerous Ideas and an interview with Olivia Lang on our website at ttbook.org. And now it's time for On Our Minds. Today we're celebrating Women's History Month by introducing a woman who was written out of American history by her own brother.
Benjamin Franklin's sister Jane thought of her brother as her second self. He was the youngest of 10 sons. She was the youngest of 7 daughters. Benny and Jenny, they were called when they were little. No two people in their family were more alike. Their lives could hardly have been more different. He ran away from home when he was 17. She never left. He taught himself to write with wit and force and style. She never learned how to spell. The day he turned 21, he wrote her a letter. She was 14, beginning a correspondence that would last until his death 63 years later. He became a printer, a philosopher, and a statesman. She became a wife, a mother, and a widow. He signed the Declaration of Independence, the Treaty of Paris, and the Constitution. She strained to form the letters of her name. He loved no one longer. She loved no one better. He wrote more letters to her than he wrote to anyone. All her life, she wrote back, letter after letter filled with news and recipes and gossip, and when she was truly sorely vexed, and only then, with her blistering opinions about politics.
Historian Jill Lepore has rescued Ben Franklin's sister Jane from the forgotten pages of history in a remarkable new biography called Book of Ages, The Life and Opinions of Jane Franklin. Steve Paulson wondered why.
Jill, why did you want to write a book about Jane Franklin? Because it's not immediately obvious that she would be a good subject for a biography.
Yeah, no, it's not obvious at all. And there's a whole genre of the women in the lives of famous men that I really, I have no interest in. So in a lot of ways, it's a book I didn't want to write, partly because it seemed sort of, it fell into a kind of a lot of traps about writing about women, but more because Jane's life is so poorly documented. And I started writing the book several different times and kept giving up because we know so much about Benjamin Franklin.
And he himself has been the subject of many biographies.
Everywhere, right, right. You know, he's on our money.
Right.
You don't want to write about the sister of someone who's on our money, I think is the rule of thumb. And then Jane's is quite different. A lot of her life is really just this yawning silence. So it's the asymmetry in the archive that was so difficult to think about because I didn't want to write. Another kind of hackneyed theme of writing about women is to kind of fetishize the silence. Oh, there's nothing left of their lives. It's so quiet. And I didn't want to do that either. So I kind of couldn't figure out how to break through all these different limitations. And yet, obviously, I was deeply compelled by her story.
Yeah. Well, what comes through in your book is how much affection there was between brother and sister. I mean, these were people who loved each other throughout their whole lives. And yet, when he wrote his own autobiography, which is one of the most famous autobiographies in the history of this country, he never mentioned her.
Yeah.
What do you make of that?
Well, it also makes me a little sad because I think there's a pretty good chance she read it. I mean, it wasn't an act of neglect or it isn't a testimony to a lack of affection for her. It's that Franklin's autobiography isn't nonfiction. You know, it's a fictional account in many ways. Really, he's writing the story of life, his life as an allegory.
Mm-hmm. Tell me something about Jane Franklin's life. Now, she married young, 15, had lots of children, but it sounds like a hard life.
Yeah, so she was the youngest of 17 children, and she was a precocious girl. Franklin ran away when he was 17. He had actually taught her to write, I think. It was quite unusual for a girl to know how to write as well as Jane knew, which was not very well, but much better than most American women at that time, as Franklin pointed out to her. And she was left behind, and it was a little bit cruel and sort of leave somebody half educated. And I think she really floundered as she was quite a rebellious young person. By the age of 14, she's clearly something has happened with this next door neighbor, this poor, hapless older man who is a saddle maker. She marries him at the age of 15, which is illegal at the time. The average age for marriage in Massachusetts is 24. You can't get married without your parents' consent until you're 16. Her parents wouldn't have given consent unless she was pregnant, I don't think. It's just impossible. But she must have lost that baby. But then she has her first child when she's 17, and that child dies in infancy. For all those years, she's corresponding with Franklin, and we have Franklin's end of the correspondence writing. But Jane's letters from those years are lost. But we do have this quite beautiful document. She calls it a book of ages, where she chronicles the births of her children and then of their deaths and her prayers at their passing. So,
and you said she had 10 children who died?
Yeah, she had 12 children. Uh-huh. Several of them died in infancy. Most of them actually grew to adulthood, and then harder fates befell them. Jane lived a very long life, as did her brother. They were the only two children that lasted anywhere near as long as they did.
Now, one thing that comes through in some of the surviving letters that she wrote to her brother is her intelligence, for one thing, her personality. She was very opinionated, obviously very bright, and she could barely spell.
Yeah, which, you know, anybody who hadn't had formal education couldn't spell. It's a not unusual thing to not be able to spell, but it's interesting because it marks someone on the page. It's just like it speaks to you what their level of education is in a wholly different way. But she was an incredibly devoted reader. I mean, think about it. She's got this house. She's living with her aged parents, taking care of her parents, and she's got this house full of children, and she takes in boarders. And yet she's reading so that when she turns 21, Franklin sends her The Ladies' Library, which is a 3-volume edition, like an anthology of writing for women. She also is pretty clear. She reads everything that Franklin ever has published. She asks him to send her everything that he has ever written and published, especially his pieces on politics and philosophy. That is an extraordinary education in political philosophy and in natural philosophy and in literature and literary style. But yet she reads a ton of other stuff, too. She reads Swift and she reads Pope and she reads the newspapers. And she's a very critical reader. There's poems she likes and poems she doesn't like. And she talks about the newspapers writers as all blusterers. She knows there's a lot of, you know, exaggeration in the political newspapers.
Now, one of the questions your book raises is, what should historians care about? What should they write about? I mean, the suggestion almost is that the life of someone like Jane Franklin is just as revealing as the life of a famous person from the 18th century.
Yeah, I did really intend. One of the times when I abandoned the book and then came back to it, I made a decision that I wanted the book itself to work as an allegory, to have the kind of ambition that Franklin's autobiography did, and to try to make an argument not just about this woman's small, obscure life, but about the writing of history. So it does, I do make that claim again and again and again. And I mean, one reason we don't have that historical account is because of what happened in the 18th century, which is that the novel was born and the conventions of novel writing and modern fiction were established in opposition to the emerging conventions of historical writing. And how those things work is that on one side is history that's about great men and involves facts and evidence. And on the other side is fiction, which is about ordinary people and their private lives and involves imagination and invention. And there's a gender divide there, and many 18th century novels are about women's lives in particular.
In fact, you have a great riff on another Jane Austen, who said at one point in one of her novels, I think, she sort of is dismissive of the kinds of histories that men wrote about popes and kings and wars. And the way you put it, in Austen, history written by men is, to women readers, fiction.
Yeah, that's a wonderful – I mean, Austen is hilarious on this point and, of course, brilliant. She writes this when she's a little girl. She writes a satire of one of these March of the Monarchs histories of England. It's very, very funny. And her point is, you know, this is all invention. How could an account of England that's only about its kings actually really be considered truth? People say this all the time. You know, fiction writers say – Our work is truth. What historians write is lies. And it's a quite interesting debate. And I mean, I thought for a while writing a novel about her, and then I decided not to, because what I wanted to call attention to were the consequences of that divide. Because when we don't have a life like Jane's in her historical account, I mean, think about When Franklin is going to be sequestered for the Constitutional Convention in 1787, she writes him a letter and she says, you know, I hear you gentlemen in Philadelphia are about to establish a new body of laws. And I just would like you to remember that one good thing to do would be to beat your swords into plowshares. She is opposed to war. She has always been concerned about guns. Now, I guess I would say it would be useful if we knew that. Right. I mean, we know a lot about what the delegates to the Constitutional Convention felt about a standing army and about matters of armament. When we take all of those people, which are the only people that inform our constitutional debate about the nature of, military authority, the bearing of arms, you're talking like 400, 500 people. And they're all very similar to one another. It's a very narrow slice of a population. I think it's really – it is – there are consequences to writing private lives of women as fiction and public lives of men as history because we don't live that way. They didn't live that way either.
Jill Lepore teaches American history at Harvard, and she's a staff writer at The New Yorker. She and Steve were talking about her new book, which is called Book of Ages, The Life and Opinions of Jane Franklin. To the Best of Our Knowledge is produced at Wisconsin Public Radio. This hour was produced by Sarah Nix, with help from Charles Monroe Kane, Stephanie Youngblood, and Doug Gordon. Our executive producer is Steve Paulson. Our technical director is Kirill Owen, and I'm Anne Strainchamps. Thanks for listening.
PRI, Public Radio International.